The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kapas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. We've had quite a weekend with Sagaki and now Founders Day. And Sagaki is about people with excessive greed who die in that state of wanting things. And the Tibetans have a phrase that says all of our suffering comes from wanting things for ourselves and all of our happiness comes from wanting things for others. And that's the awakening of the bodhisattva mind. And so today we're celebrating a ceremony for Master Kato Chisan, who's our founder, our temple founder, and he's a bodhisattva. So we go from the greed of the hungry ghost to the bodhisattva of Kho Zenji. Now, how do you get from A to B? So this is the awakening to true wisdom. That's the way Dogen puts it. When you awaken to true wisdom is when you're willing to accept that all living beings can enter enlightenment before you'll enjoy your own. And that willingness to basically to see the Buddha in all things. And there are several different ways of looking at this bodhisattva mind, how to awaken the bodhisattva mind. But we first have to look at the delusion that our society sells in terms of thinking that you're going to solve your problems with more money or more stuff or more things or whatever, and that there's this culture here that is based on needing more. And everybody actually comes fully equipped. You have the Buddha nature. Reverend Master Chusen says that it fills and contains all things. And if you recognize that you already have everything you need, there isn't anything more than you could get, especially external things, that's going to make you more adequate than adequate. But we come from a society where we're told that we're basically there's something wrong with us just because we're born. And I was talking about Master Hubert this week and about radio programs in the 1930s. So he was telling me about sneaking downstairs to hear Mae West and Charlie McCarthy reenact the creation story. And her great line was, "Here, Charlie, take a bite." Well, this idea of there's something wrong with us just because we were born comes from out of that delusion, and we have to see it as a delusion. And we have to recognize that this whole idea of a self that we're trying to get more for is actually an illusion. And our mind creates this illusion because, you know, we think that there's a self. And it takes a good long time in training to recognize that anything that we consider as a self is actually just empty. But it doesn't happen automatically. We have to see how, for our own selves, how that works, and that that illusion of self comes from our trying to grab onto things and hold on to them. It doesn't work. It doesn't make us more adequate. We're already adequate. But the bodhisattva mind is expressed in the paramitas and in the four wisdoms. The paramitas are the paramita of generosity, realizing that it's what we give that enriches us, not by what we have. It's what we give that actually makes us whole. And generosity works on all sorts of levels. You know, just paying attention to what you're doing is an act of generosity. Giving your attention to the persons that you're talking to, or the dog or the cat that you're feeding, or the whatever, just paying attention to your driving when you're driving a car, and paying attention to the things that you're dealing with, and the people in the store, and the people on the street, and seeing them as Buddhas, and not just treating them indifferently, but treating them, every being that you meet, with respect. That's a way of being generous. It's not just how much money you give to charities and things, although there's nothing wrong with that, that helps everybody. But how you deal with people, how you see them as Buddhas, do you see them as through the eyes of respect? Are you grateful for the people in the grocery store? I mean, how many millions of people does it take to fill up that grocery store? If you think that you know, your life is dependent upon all these beings that provide the food there. And so it's pretty amazing when we start to realize just how much gratitude and respect we should have just for the existence of a grocery store or a gas station or a car or my neighbors or whatever it is. And treating these beings with respect, because you're enriched by that respect, you're not diminished by that. The more you show respect for others, the more you see their Buddha nature, you see it with the eyes of a Buddha. And it's because of our perception. If we can see things as Buddhas, when we die, we'll see things as Buddhas after our death too. But if we are looking at people through this eye of judgment, well, do I like this person, or I don't like the guy's hairdo. No, look at my hairdo. There's nothing there to like. And we distort reality through this filter of like and dislike. So instead of just seeing things as they are, we see it through this filter. And that's what creates this illusion, these delusions. I remember having an argument with my mother about delusion and illusion. I was about 5 years old. I was convinced that I knew exactly what that was. She was patient enough to correct me. The second of the paramitas is the keeping of the precepts and the restraining of our greeds and angers and fears. The precepts are really an explanation of how you act like a Buddha. If you want to know what the Buddha knows, you start have to act like what the Buddha was behaving like. It's just that simple. So you be very careful about not killing or not stealing, not taking that which is not given. We can't go through life without killing something, however. We're just breathing, we're probably killing microbes. And if you walk across the lawn, you're probably killing some little beings. And even if you might be vegetarian, you're still killing the cabbages and the carrots. And you try to do as little harm as possible. And be as grateful for those beings that allow you to live. And accepting responsibility for the fact that, yes, I killed the cabbage. It just doesn't scream as loud as the cow and the lamb and that sort of thing. So, and you take responsibility for that. Abusing sexuality, just having that in your mind all the time is an abuse of it. Just thinking about it too much. Speaking the truth. We're here to know the truth, so it's really important that we are honest. It just doesn't help to be dishonest about things. Not selling the wine of delusion. That started out as not using drugs and alcohol, but it's also the wine of delusion is the illusion, this delusion of self that we sell all the time. I want this. I don't like that. And then there's two about speaking against others, not putting other people down. That whole judgmental thing. the mind does about liking and disliking what other people are doing. And then there's not being proud of yourself and devaluing others, just putting other people down, and puffing yourself up to make yourself feel better. Well, we're all in this together. There's nobody who has more of the Buddha nature than somebody else. And it's really important just to respect all the Buddhas that you meet. Whether you think they're Buddhas or not is your perception. But some Buddhas teach us by showing us what not to do. They're still Buddhas, but they're showing us what not to do. Our master used Richard Nixon as a good example of that when he was president. And it stopped us from judging him, because he was just really doing what everybody, you know, thinks that they should be able to do. If they're the right person for the job, they should be able to do whatever they need to get it. But it's not without karmic consequences. So, and then the next one is not being mean and giving either dharma or wealth. This is the one on generosity. And then the last is not defaming the three treasures. And these are the 10 great precepts. The first three are the taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and ceasing from evil, doing only good, and doing good for others. They all kind of telescope into those. The next of the paramitas, paramita, by the way, means that which carries us to the other shore. So the next of the paramitas is right effort, or training with vigor, or generosity, or willingness. Doing whatever you need to do to be of service. There was a young man here a couple of years ago who had this kind of natural bodhisattva mind. He would, when you were working with him, he'd try to position himself to be of greatest help to the person he was working with. And the harder the job got, the more he liked it. He says, "That's up for a challenge." And that willingness is the one that is undaunted by the challenge. You might not know what to do, but you can figure it out, or find out, or ask somebody, or whatever. But that willingness to do whatever is necessary to do in order to do the work that you need to do is the crucial part. And the next paramita is patience, and I've been looking at patience a lot lately. The usual Buddhist concept of patience is one of enduring difficulties and being it's forbearance, kind of putting up with all sorts of insults or difficulties or enemies attacking or whatever. And Thich Nhat Hanh had a lovely take on that. He's analyzed the Chinese characters for patience, and it starts with a heart at the bottom, and it starts with a sharp knife above the heart. And what he says is that if you make your heart big enough, that sharp knife doesn't cause anybody any harm. And that opening of the heart is, he analogized, the Buddha analogy of course was, if you take a handful of salt and you put it in a glass of water, you can't drink it. But a same handful of salt in a river, and it's no big deal. And the same with this, the practicing of the paramitas is a way of opening your heart. And I was asking the other night in meditation, well, how do you open the heart? The silence that I usually listen to and half the time ignore got very, very intense, and so it couldn't be ignored. And it blossomed into this really beautiful, joyful experience. And I was thinking, well, that's really what you have to do, is you really have to just pay attention to your meditation, not let the mind wander. See what it is that you have to do to really give yourself to whatever it is that you're doing. And that's the way the heart opens. If your mind is in two different places. I was talking to somebody the other day. He says, I'm seeing things in different dimensions and I don't know which one is right. And the mind does that. The mind creates distractions and diversions, and we end up doing our daydreaming and our daily planning doing something else. And this generous heart is, again, this giving yourself fully to what it is that you're doing. And in the Shishogi, he talks about, the next paramita is the meditation. And that's number five. And again, that meditation is the most important thing you can learn in life, because it's the thing that you can take with you when you die. And if you can use your meditation to see all beings as Buddhas, and then the fierce beings that may come up at the time of death will just be fierce Buddhas, and you'll be able to greet them as Buddhas. Because the things that you see after death really are just your perceptions. And so the meditation is this ability to let go of the self and just be still. Just listen. That's what somebody asked, what's it? Mother Teresa, what she does when she prays, and she says, I listen. And I say, well, what does God do? And she says, he listens. And if we can learn to listen, if we can learn just to be still, that silence is what got Avalokiteshvara his awakening. It's described at length in the Shirogama Sutra, where all these 25 bodhisattvas and arhats describe how they got enlightenment, and they all used a different sense object or meditation on one of the earth, air, fire, water things. And at the end of that, the Buddha says to Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, well, which is the best for Ananda and the people of the Dharma ending age? And that's us. We're the Dharma in Dharma ending age. And Manjushri has a very long description of how the one that Avalokiteshvara used was the best for us. And it is just basically learning to listen to silence. And he went into that silence until the silence disappeared, and then whatever came up after that disappeared, and he kept going into that until his mind merged with the compassion of the universe, and simultaneously with all the cries for help. Because they're not different, they're not separate. But we still have to ask for help. And that willingness to do our meditation is acknowledging the value of your spiritual life. And if you can do that on a regular basis, even if it's just short periods, but doing it every day makes a very big difference in terms of what you're preparing yourself for at the time of death. Because if you can learn to just come back to being still and open your heart to that stillness, it changes your relationship to that which is undying and unborn. Because that really, that unborn, undying, eternal Buddha nature is within all of us. And we have to keep coming back to that stillness to be in touch with it. Every time you bring your mind back to being still, you are open to that. And it's just a constant process of training yourself to do that over and over again. And as Dilgo Khyentse was a famous Lama from Tibet, and he's one of these people who, there wasn't one teaching that if anybody knew something, he would want to learn it. And he was being interviewed on one of his trips to the West by little kids. And this little 10-year-old boy says, well, what's the difference between money and enlightenment? And he didn't have to pause. He just said, well, money eventually runs out and enlightenment increases forever. So we're in this for the long run here. And your meditation puts you in touch with that forever, right there, here and now. Because it's this present moment is the gateway to the eternal. And the meditation puts you in touch with that. Whether you know that or not doesn't matter. Just keep doing it. thing, it will eventually open up. And that opening up is this development of the bodhisattva mind, putting the good of others ahead of ourselves. Because it's all these Buddhas that we're we're helping. Let me explain too a little bit about Koho Zenji while we're celebrating today. He was born shortly after Japan was opened up to the West, and during the time of the Tokugawas, for the couple hundred years before Japan opened its doors, was they suppressed Christianity and women because they the first Westerners who started to come to Japan were targeting these very influential women to help convert their husbands or partners or whatever. And the Tokugawas didn't want that to happen. So they didn't allow women to be educated for a couple hundred years. And one of the things that Koho Zenji did about 100 years ago was to start schools for the kindergartens, grade schools, high schools, college for women. And the last of his opening those doors for women was inviting River Master Jiyu to come from England to be in his monastery. And she was the first, and as far as I know, they actually the only one actually that had gotten through Sojiji as a full priest. And although the Soto Zen is changing now, but he opened that door to try to help women get educated, and also for we wouldn't be here without his willingness to do that. And if you think of the hundreds of thousands of people that have been through all of the temples that have come out of what he did with inviting River Master Jiyu to come to Japan, is quite amazing. I was just thinking this morning how there must be, in 40-some years that this temple has been here, how many thousands of people have been here? And there's temples in Berkeley and Pine Mountain and in Oregon and Washington and Canada and South Carolina and all over England and Scotland and Wales and Netherlands and Germany. And if you think of the thousands of people that have benefited from the Dharma as a result of what one person saying, well, come to my monastery and be my disciple. And the fact that she was female gave him the opportunity to try to open that door to help others. And if you think that half the people in Japan were women, they didn't have that opportunity. Now they do. And that's an example of what one person can do for the benefit of others. It's really quite amazing what that bodhisattva mind is about. Dogen talks about the four wisdoms: charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. And this is an explanation of how you develop discerning wisdom. It's through that generosity, that generous mind. It's through compassion, this tenderness. It gives the example of even if you speak about somebody in a kind way when they're not there, their hearts will be warmed. And benevolence is a law of the universe. People, Dogen says, stupid people believe they'll lose something by giving help to others. But benevolence helps everyone, being a law of the universe. The more we help people, I notice that skillful means comes out of the meditation. The stiller you are in your meditation when you're dealing with other people, and the more respectful you are of them, the more you find skillful ways of addressing difficulties. And that skillful means is this benevolence means good actions. And the actions that arise from that stillness are the ones that are usually the most skillful. And the ones that arise out of our anger, frustration, fears, impatience, whatever, are the ones that create other problems. And so, generosity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. Sympathy is the willingness to feel with both the pains and difficulties of suffering of other beings, as well as to feel a sympathetic joy for the success of others. There's nothing that hurts us more than jealousy, thinking so somebody else has something that we don't have. Well, that's so silly. because essentially everybody has the Buddha nature, and it's going to be expressed in the 6 billion different ways at the moment. And our willingness to see the Buddha nature in others is, and to be in harmony with that loving kindness and wisdom that exists within all beings. That's what this sympathy is about. It's to everybody has experienced losses and death. There was a woman at the time at the Buddha, one of his relatives, whose baby died, and she was just totally distraught and didn't know what to do. And she carried this baby around. Finally, she went to the Buddha and said, you know, will you bring my baby back to life? And he said, well, if you can bring me a mustard seed from a house where there's nobody has died, I'll bring your baby back to life. So she went to every house in the village, and everybody was willing to offer her a mustard seed, but there wasn't any house that hadn't experienced a death. And then she brought the baby back and asked the Buddha to bury it, because she could see that she was not alone, that everybody else participated in her loss, and that it wasn't some sort of private thing, that karma, the karmic consequences where we feel suffering, it's not there to punish us, it's there to teach us. And what we have to learn is to accept that that's just a reality of the existence of being a human. Is that there are some things that are difficult and some things that we don't particularly like, and so what if we don't like them? They're just there. And the more we're willing just to accept things on their terms, accept the truth on as it presents itself, the more generous we can be, because that's that opening of the heart. Not wanting things to be just the way I want them to be, but just as they are. That all of that suffering is to come from wanting things for myself, and all of that happiness is for wanting things for others. And it's just that opening of the heart that allows that to happen. And it's not a question of understanding any sort of doctrines or having beliefs or anything. It's just how we treat each other and how we treat ourselves. And that willingness to see what it is that I can give to a situation that's difficult, instead of, I want something here. Well, maybe it's giving something here that will solve the problem, instead of clinging to my ideas about what I want or what I like. Maybe it's just, okay, it is as it is. And what's going to help? What can I give that will actually make the situation work? And that generosity, that just, okay, I can't have what I want. Let's see what we can make things work here. And it's that opening ourselves up to this wider view that there may be more possibilities than just what I want. Maybe there's something bigger or better or something that will help everybody and not just me. And that's this bodhisattva mind, is this mind that's willing to expand forever, to open forever, to see infinite possibilities here, and not just what I like or what I want or whatever. And developing that bodhisattva mind is something that can happen. It happens every day. There's an opportunity. Just getting out of bed in the morning. What's your attitude when you get out of bed? You welcome that new day? I usually have to fight the cat to get out of bed. Give her the three homages. She likes to plant herself right there where I can't get out of bed. But how... are looking at our attitude and see what it is What can I change about me that will help? And that's, if you start looking in that way, you'll find all sorts of things. But when you're, when you wake up and you're, I don't want to be awake today, I want to go back to sleep. Well, this practice is about waking up. So get used to it. Because it's going to happen forever. And that bodhisattva mind is what helps that happen forever. Is that opening of the heart, the willingness to help. Okay, let's do the bodhisattva vows. However innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it.